Welcome to the Human Performance Podcast. Here we talk about everything to do with human performance and how leaders and organizations can get the best out of themselves and their people. I'm your host, Alex Young.
My guest on the podcast this week is Nigel Payne. Nigel is a change-focused leader with a worldwide reputation and a unique grasp of media, learning and development in the public, private and academic sectors. He's written three books in the learning and technology space, and while at the BBC, headed up their learning development operation, developing leaders and a brand new onboarding experience to ramp up all of their staff. Hi Nigel, welcome to the podcast. How are you doing today?
Alex, I'm very well, thanks very much. Good to see you. Good to talk to you.
Well, it's an absolute pleasure connecting. We were just chatting before we started recording that you're currently trapped in Melbourne during the pandemic. So it's great to be able to connect remotely, although not in person, which is obviously the best way to connect. I think we can probably agree on. But when I was looking at your background, you've got an absolutely incredible backstory and career, and have spoken at some amazing things and written some amazing books. But rather than me butchering your introduction for everyone, it'd be great if you could introduce yourself to everybody listening.
Alex, I will butcher it all myself. I'm quite happy to do that. I never quite know how to talk about myself because I do a lot of things. But one of them is I'm a writer. I think I can call myself that. I've just written three books in the last 5 years. There's a fourth one bubbling up in my head. And I find writing enormously pleasurable. And I used to use my periods in Australia as my writing time. But that's not been possible of late because of the restrictions in getting into the country. So I write. I also teach academically. I'm an academic director on a doctoral program at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. It's an Ivy League school, and it is an amazing program. We have 41 students going through the academic blocks, and then another 50-odd in the dissertation block, finishing off or beginning their research for their thesis. And that has been enormously pleasurable because because it's a post-experience qualification, the average age of people over 40, they have enormous knowledge and experience of the world. And I kind of sit in awe at their feet often. And it's a real pleasure just working with them, mentoring, teaching, and being involved in that. I also work with organizations all over the world. If you want to put a down in a nutshell, I would say that I try to help organizations build more effective workforces by liberating people's knowledge, creativity, ability to learn, and therefore ability to pivot, solve problems, and make organizations more successful. And I also do a monthly TV program called Learning Now TV. I host that along with Kate Graham. And I have a weekly podcast with Martin Cousins called From Scratch. Very short, about 6 or 8 minutes that we try to do each week. Just one point, one little insight, which we talk about together, we ruminate on. And apart from that, I speak at conferences. That I'm speaking at two this week, two or three last week, and so on through the year. Unfortunately, being in Australia, I'm in this time zone nightmare where I'm working in the middle of the night and I'm very, very early in the morning. And I have this great chunk of the middle of the day completely free. But that's life. So that's me. I'm in Australia until the new year. I'll be back in London in the new year, and normal service will resume as soon as possible after that. But I just have a lot of interests, a lot of connections. I work with a lot of organizations. I meet a lot of people in a lot of ways. So I just really feel privileged to engage with people from all sorts of different circumstances in all sorts of different parts of the world. And it really is a joy. I've thoroughly enjoyed the last few years of my life when I've really tried to be as global as I possibly can. And in spite of the time zones, it's been fun.
And anyone who listens to this podcast knows that I'm a massive learning and development nerd, and that my mum is a now retired school teacher, so I've probably got some weird predisposition to learning and training in my genetics. But you're, you know, a little bit similar in that respect, in that, you know, you kind of cut your teeth at the BBC on their learning side of things and made some amazing progress there for them as an organisation. But before you even got there, what was your, you know, your initial kind of fascination with learning and technology and improving things for corporates? Or was that something that developed over time?
It did develop over time, and corporates came later. What I was always involved with, I've always been involved with helping adults learn, helping adults perform. And what I realized very, very early on is that the conventional face-to-face kind of classroom doesn't really suit lots of people for all sorts of reasons. It didn't really suit their learning. And I got very early into what we called open learning, which was packaging learning. So we would create flexibility, any place, any time, any way was the motto that we used. And so when personal computing took off, I saw that as an absolute window of opportunity and just jumped in with both feet. So I've been working with technology since mainframes, not that old, but I've been working with technology certainly since personal computers started to really engage. And, you know, I went from talking to people about the theoretical possibility one time in the future when things are much faster and so on, to this is now the reality. So I'm kind of living a dream that I've had for maybe 20 years now. Everything is possible. And I got in very early when the internet became a thing, the World Wide Web. I started to work with, you know, online material, online learning. And in some ways, we took a step backwards because we had much more integrated video and interactive video using discs rather than online. So when online began, you couldn't do that. But the interactivity was what interested me. I still adore hyperlinking. I think hyperlinking is the savior of the world. The fact that you can jump alongside your imagination and you can have infinite options as you branch your way through any kind of knowledge. And those things really excited me. And I began to put them together, and I ended up running a learning technology company for a while as CEO, and getting really heavily involved in software and technology, and then jumping out of that into corporate and BBC, and then into corporate. So I came late into corporate, but it's just big. You know, I love the scale of working with big organizations, and you've got the budgets and you've got the vision to be able to do some remarkable things on a very large scale. So I started off in a very small scale working with handfuls of people, and ended up on a very large scale working with hundreds of thousands, potentially hundreds of thousands of people. And on the way, you know, I've got my doctorate, and I think I've become a thinker a little bit, and a writer as much as I possibly can. Okay, maybe not as good as I would like to be on any front, but as a researcher, as a writer, as a thinker, all of that gets fed back into practice, into what I can do with organizations. And that really excites me. I'm not an academic. I don't really want to just sit in a university and do research. I want to get in there into organizations, but I want to have a research base. We tell our students at the University of Pennsylvania that we want to build scholar practitioners. People who have the evidence-based scholarship and courage to follow through ideas, but they're practitioners. They do it in the real world. And I like to see myself as that kind of scholar practitioner in humility. You know, I wouldn't say I'm great shakes at anything, but I do my best to bring evidence and to not do anything that is just based on fad, favor, fancy, or some kind of wise words from a supplier. I challenge everything, and I think that's stood me in good stead for most of my life.
And before we dive too far down the rabbit hole of looking at the different types of technologies or some of the specific things you've done, just for anyone listening to this podcast who might be considering, why learning is so important to individuals and organizations, at the kind of real base level, what's your sort of opinion, and you touched on it a little bit when you were giving your introduction, what's the real value to an individual and an organization of adopting learning into the way that they work?
Well, if you once, Alex, you were a lovely little baby and your mum was very, very adoring of this baby in the cot. How did you go from where you were when you were born? I kind of almost with an unformed brain, just looking at the world and exploring the world. You did it through learning, and you learnt massively, and your brain built connections massively. And I think that is the way we survive, by learning. But somehow we got into our heads that learning stops at 18 or 20. And back to Piaget, the founding fathers of child-centered education, he never was interested in anyone over 18 because the brain was formed, everything was fixed. And what we know now is there are dimensions and dimensions of adult learning. And the way that adults learn is different from a 5-year-old or a 10-year-old or even a 20-year-old. And what we need to do is encourage and exploit those innate abilities for everyone to learn for the whole of their life, and smash those myths which say, I'm too old to learn, can't do that, I learned those skills 20 years ago, they'll last me till I retire. Because we know that all of that is rubbish. A, they won't last you, and B, someone of 80 is as equally able to learn well and to keep their cognitive life alive as someone of 18. And so there's a world to win there. And my belief is that if organizations are going to thrive in the kind of unknowing, confusion and complexity of the world we live in now, it's only when that their staff are able to keep learning and keep pivoting that makes any sense to me. So this is the age of learning. And I find it extraordinary that people don't say, well, that's obvious, but they don't. And it's still challenged. And learning budgets get cut faster than any other budgets, often when it's seen as kind of irrelevant. And also just that concept of different kinds of adult learning, from informal to formal, from with people on your own, and to be able to make those links and connections. And another thing that I believe, which may sound to you slightly insane, but in a learning organization, the learning is in the spaces between people, not in individuals. And another mission of mine is that we spend far, far too long focusing on individuals and individual capability and individual excellence, because that somehow scales up to the whole organization. But it doesn't. You just have a whole bunch of individuals who know a lot of stuff. But when one goes or two go or a whole team go, you've got a whole. Whereas if you've built the connections in the organization, that's why I say it's in the spaces. If you build the connections, whole teams can go and the organization is resilient. It just refills those spaces because the organization knows, not the individuals. So that's my latest mission, is to convince people that some kind of investment on building the links and connections that enable the organization to learn is not just something quite nice to do, but critical money that should be spent. And it's the only way I can see surviving. We need organizations that can learn. That's fundamental to what I believe. And a lot of my doctoral research was about exploring how come a lot of the promising research from the 1990s just got dropped in the 20th century, 21st century. We just stopped thinking about that. And in some ways, technology did that. It drove us down this, you have a personal computer, you are personally learning. We didn't think about how we connect and how we build connections. So that's a kind of big issue for me at the moment. And it does resonate. That resonates in organizations when they see things going wrong because they haven't got organizational learning in place. And it resonates with organizations that are going down that route and seeing the huge benefits that accrue.
Well, it's a fantastic point. And it, leads me on to my next point, which was, when you started your role in the BBC, I think I'm correct in saying that one of the key things you implemented was an onboarding system, and the ability to share materials across an organization. You know, just kind of honing in on those two points. Why is onboarding, for anyone listening, just so important for any organization?
But it's particularly important for the BBC because when we created a universal onboarding program for all staff, right up to governor. So it didn't matter who you were, you went through the same program. And in those days, it was 5 days of onboarding. Because people came into the organization in different locations for different roles, and the way they were treated and the way they were introduced to the organization was completely different. And you could often take really enthusiastic people whose life ambition was to work for the BBC, and in one miserable morning of being lectured at what your pension rights were, destroy that enthusiasm and kind of turn you against the BBC. So the idea was to create a culture that was consistent. And there was also some kind of fundamental, like, not quite human rights, that's putting it far too strongly. But, for example, every single person joining the BBC, regardless of where they joined it, were flown to London and they watched programs being made, programs going out live. And many people had worked 40 years in the BBC and had never been in a studio, never seen a program, didn't know how they were put together. And we thought it was crazy. And we got everyone to make a program. We used my learning and development facilities to create a program. So, and in that program, we had our new onboarding staff doing cameras, direction, scripting, front of camera, and whatever it might be. And that was really exciting. People got the magic of the BBC in a way that they hadn't got before. And we also felt it was incredibly important that those people in their first few days should meet some of the senior executives and they should be able to ask them anything they wanted. And Greg Dyke, who was the director general, Greg did an awful lot of those upfronts, they were called. A lot of those discussions. He couldn't do them all, but he did lots and lots. And people would ask him really cheeky questions. And he loved it. He loved the naivety of people asking, well, why doesn't the BBC do this? Or people say, I read in the paper. And you wouldn't do that after 2 or 3 weeks in the organization. You'd be, oh, I better be careful what I say. But we got lots of naivety. And the fact we had new governors, trustees of the BBC, sitting with junior staff in their first few days, saying, what is it about the BBC? How do you feel about the BBC? Getting some real insight into the organization. So it was expensive. I accept that. But it was also incredibly valuable. And it did turn people from kind of fairly neutral for the BBC and what it could do for them to really positive. It also created networks. We encouraged each group. We put them in cohorts, each cohort to stay together. So if 5 years down the track, you got stuck or your career came to an abrupt halt, you could contact your cohort and say, hey, anyone got any ideas? I really don't know what to do next. And that helped save people as well. They found new jobs. They got support and help from people they'd started the first day with. So I'll defend that program. It was really important. And the whole business of exchanging information and material around the BBC, that was the attempt to build a learning organization, really. We had literally thousands of people sharing their expertise on a day-to-day basis. And we created just the software that allowed someone to ask a question and someone else to answer that question. And we built loads of communities of practice to manage that flow and offer some kind of ownership of expertise. So these things, now they're looked at as that's what we always do. But at the time, it was challenging. And we got some pushback. You know, I remember people in HR were terrified at the thought that anyone could answer a question that anyone asked. What happens if they say something? What happens if we get like, what happens if? And we said that the system would be self-policing. And it was. That if someone said something wrong, someone would say, Alex, you shouldn't have said that. I think you should retract that because of this and this and this. And 99.99 times out of 100, the person would willingly retract or put in an addendum saying, I wasn't aware of all of this. So the system really grew very fast because it was an organization full of really knowledgeable people on virtually everything. And They've never had a chance to put that expertise into use. And it, now I look back, it was all about building the synapses in the organization, building those connections and links, which would, I hope, still maybe stand the organization in good stead, although it was I left a long time ago. So there's probably no trace left. But I think the philosophy has continued, and there are other means of staying in touch now than the software we use, which is quite crude and simple. But hey, you know, that's what was available in 2004 or 5 or 6.
Well, I mean, it's super interesting, actually, because you know, my company, Verti, were completely remote with all our employees, and especially over the pandemic period, a lot of organizations have had to do that by necessity. And just hearing you talk through the structure of that program, especially where you're getting people to actually, you know, I would call it use the product, i.e., you know, create a television experience. For us at Verti, where we do a lot of content learning creation, all our new hires are tasked with creating a video, interactive video experience, using some of the virtual humans, creating a live stream, just like they would be. And their sort of targeted audiences, their peers in the organization, so to educate them on something that they're very passionate about. So we've had everything from skydiving experiences to how to cook tofu in Boston. So it's really kind of, you know, fun and gets people understanding the product very, very early on, which I think is one of the cool things for any, certainly technology company.
By doing. Really
any company.
Yeah.
But by doing exactly totally right. And I think, you know, one of the funnest parts for my week, whenever we've got any new people joining, you know, just like Greg Dyke did, I always sort of give up my time to speak to new hires. And that kind of childlike mindset of people coming into the business is always really, really fun, where they're asking questions based on what they've seen online and other things like that. And it is great. And I think if we, you know, dive into some of the stats behind it that we've now got from places like kind of Glassdoor and other things, there's about, you know, 20% of staff turnover in the first 45 days of employment. You know, if people don't like what they're seeing at a new company that they're joining, that's kind of the current talent market we're in, especially on the back of the stuff that's happened with the pandemic. And, you know, if you've got a good onboarding process, Glassdoor reckon that you can retain upwards of 82% of your new hires and boost productivity by 70%. You know, just for anyone listening who likes data, but it's so impactful, and it's incredible that people aren't, you know, still big organizations don't have an optimized onboarding process. I remember being in the NHS, and as you say, every time I changed hospital, I'd go through the same things. I'd have to come in person. I'd have to sit through fire hazard talks and all this type of stuff. And there was one hospital that I went to in the southwest of England where they did it digitally, you know, about 4 or 5 years ago, and actually gave their employees an extra day off in lieu for getting through that online before they started. And that, again, was just an example of them being innovative, utilizing technology, and all the staff absolutely loved it. And then when they started, just the feeling was this hospital is much more optimized, much more caring for staff. And I think that, you know, the other big thing with onboarding is, and you could probably extend this to the whole learning space in general, actually, is if people are more prepared and they're more confident going into a role, especially if that role has elements that are quite scary, whether you're having to go into to do sales and speak to prospects, or whether you're like me and going into an operating theatre or speaking to patients, your stress levels naturally reduce if you feel supported during those early days. And it really helps to kind of build corporate wellness and things. So that's just sort of my reflections on that.
But no, that's true. We've got data on that as well. All of that is true. The other thing I've always found is that people in their first month of employment are full of seeing much clearer than people who've been there, you know, 2 years or 3 years. And to really listen to what they have to say, you can get some great stuff, great information out, and you can improve it. But you've got to listen to them and treat them as welcome friends, not as tentative belonging, maybe if you make it and get through your first whatever. Now, that some organizations still do, you know, they make people feel awful for their first few months as a kind of ritual, and only allow them in once they've gone through a certain number of hoops. Whereas I think on day one, you've got to really galvanize people and find out what really impresses them about the company. And I think it's a good question. You're in charge. What did you like about the company? What do you think's really frustrating now after 2 days that we could do something about. They'll tell you, but they won't 3 months in because they'll have forgotten. So I agree with you. I think there's lots of opportunities to improve. Yeah, even now.
And I think, equally when people are joining from different organizations with, some diverse backgrounds in terms of their experience,
that first 30 days is
a really good time to kind of extract any information that's still fresh in their minds. So, we always ask people, is there anything that your previous employer did that we don't do, that could help you ramp more quickly or that kind of could support you and things like that? And it's a great way to sort of extract some of that information that's still fresh in their brains. Digressing on from onboarding, you've got a huge wealth of knowledge in both the learning and technology space, and as you mentioned, have written 3 books. For anyone kind of who might be new in a learning and technologies role or learning development role, what are some of the key themes throughout all of those books where you would suggest people start if they're looking to improve learning and development in their organization?
They're all different, and they're all part of a journey in a way. My own journey. The first book, The Learning Challenge, which is now, I think, 6 years old. The Learning Challenge was really written for me when I started out in corporate learning. So it's giving an overview, trying to put corporate learning in context of change in organizations and trying to familiarize people with the different techniques and different options, I guess, that you can use to do a good job, to be effective in your role of a learning and development specialist. The second book's on leadership, and that was born out of the sheer frustration that why is so much money wasted on ineffective leadership development? And I wanted to put my finger on, so it's not all wasted. Some is brilliant. What is the difference between mediocre, no change, nothing happens leadership development, and leadership development is transformational? So that was answering a question. And then the third one was more evangelical, saying, look, there is a thing as learning culture. Most people don't know anything about it. I'm going to explore it, and I'm going to try and entice you to come on that journey to build a genuine learning culture in your organization. So if you like, the first book, I'm kind of inside L&D. The second book, I'm half in, half out. The third book, I'm standing outside saying, come on, come in this direction. So they're very different, and they're for different audiences.
And particularly around the point of leadership, we do a lot of training around soft skills because, for me personally, I feel that's just so important. Having been through my medical training where you are taught with role plays and taught how to communicate with patients and break bad news. And certainly when I've then translated into a business setting, that ability to have both difficult conversations and also sensitive conversations with anyone, especially at leadership level, is just so vital. What are some of your reflections around things like soft skills and how you actually develop leaders in practical terms for organizations?
Well, I don't call them soft skills. I call them generative skills. I think they're the core skills that help us build other skills. And when we call them soft skills, it's like almost we can dismiss them because they're just soft. We need hard skills. I don't think there's anything more hard than creating a bedrock of generative skills in people. And it's also true that I think if you can help people learn to learn, they will fix a lot of things themselves. So, my view is get away from a dependency culture into an independency culture. And the best leadership in organizations is when the leaders get together and solve their own problems and fix it themselves and don't see leadership development as an inoculation that occurs every 5 years for 3 days and that'll do you for the next 5 years. Leadership is an ongoing journey. And if you can just see it as that. And I suppose my other observation is that, and it was struck me very forcibly when I was doing the research for that book, is that so many organizations try to deliver vanilla leadership development. They say, well, that worked for Alex. We give it to you. Totally different organizations. Leadership only resonates when it's in context. It's for a particular organization, a particular circumstance, a particular group of people at a particular time. And that allows it to take root and actually change things. If you have something that is all about the generic way of breaking bad news, that doesn't work often because in context, what do we do in our organization now? What are we trying to change? What options have we got in that context? So when people take it on board. It's embedded and it leads to substantial behavioral change. If it's vanilla, it doesn't embed, and therefore it leads to, well, I had a really good time and I learned a few models, and yep, that all sounds great in theory. Doesn't work in my organization, and nothing happens. So I'm really passionate about contextual, particularly in leadership development. It has to be contextual.
No, I mean, amen to that. I mean, one of the things that I sort of reflected on when I was leaving healthcare was that each of the different sort of hospitals that I worked in did things slightly differently. And you need an element of customization if you're, especially if you're using any type of technology, but also if you're doing in-person role play, you need things that are pertinent to the employees at whatever organization that they are working for. And people will do things slightly differently. And as you say, there's no one size fits all. And that's why, you know, having the ability to kind of customize things and make it bespoke to your organizational needs is just so important. In terms of, you know, you mentioned things like hyperlinks and CD-ROMs at the top of the conversation. Obviously, we're seeing a huge uptick in educational technology, especially during the pandemic, where people were forced to pivot to a fully kind of remote digital environment. You also mentioned bits about academic research and making sure that things are validated and they do actually impact people. Again, something that I'm very, very passionate about. But I'd be interested in getting your take on what technologies you've seen pop up recently and what you're excited about that you know, you feel have got academic backup to show that they work and deliver impact.
And what I'm excited about really is the whole concept of a learning ecosystem. I think you can really do that now, and you can plug bits of technology together to fit and suit the individual organization. You're not forced to take something that some organization has told you is a good idea and please sign a check. So that individualization allows that contextualization, which is important. And the worst thing I've seen is when people in L&D outsource their brain to a supplier who says, leave it to us. We know everything. I think that's a really bad idea. Always stay in control. But I think all of the technologies are really interesting, from simple basic stuff like the ability to share, work together virtually, little things like, you know, sticky notes online in a community, Padlet and other things, really low tech in a way, but incredibly powerful, through to AI as a way of personalizing and understanding learning needs. I think that's obviously there are ethical issues and there are control issues, but that's unstoppable. And then we get to things like augmented and virtual reality, which have their place for sure. I don't think they're the full, you don't do everything in virtual reality, everything in augmented reality, but the idea of being able to get an as-if experience, you know, that one of the things that makes learning embed is this emotion intensity of the experience, and you can do that with technology in a way that it often is impossible to do even in real life, because it's too dangerous or tricky or whatever, or just geography, you just can't get to some specialist unit. So I think we've got a great future of a mixed economy, really, of learning, and I want to encourage that mixed economy. I don't think we should throw all our eggs into any one basket. And all of those technologies are being frantically researched, and there's great data on all of those things I've talked about being really key components to creating that, I suppose, a lifelong learning community in an organization at the speed which the organization needs to move. That's the important thing as well. It's about velocity as much as anything else.
No, fantastic. I mean, that's a brilliant summary of what we're seeing in the current landscape. Nigel, as we sort of start to wrap things up towards the end of the podcast, I always ask people who their inspiration or what we call a human performance hero is. For you, have you got any sort of examples that spring to mind?
I have lots and lots, but if I had to pick one, I think I'd pick Robert Swan. I went to Antarctica in 2016 on an expedition where I was doing the leadership component, and Rob was the expedition leader, and he's still the only human being who's ever walked solo, well, not solo, but walked without backup to the North and the South Poles. And he's an extraordinary guy, and he's dedicated his life really to preserving Antarctica for future generations. And he's worked with thousands and thousands of people who he's taken to Antarctica to make them become basically global ambassadors. So when the Antarctic treaties run out in the 2040s, he wants his ambassadors to stand up and say, do not allow anything to happen to Antarctica. Leave it as the last pristine place on Earth. So he said that at one moment when he was walking to the South Pole and it was really tough, it was in a blizzard, he kind of made a pact with Antarctica and said, if you let me live, if you let me get to my destination, I'll spend my life protecting you. And he's stuck to his knitting. And he's an amazingly inspirational guy. And he's never lost his genuine enthusiasm for helping other people see what he sees. So he's a teacher amongst many other things. And I always look at Rob and his determination and his courage. And I think, you know, if I could hold a candle to Rob, I'd be very, very pleased. Great guy, really great guy.
Fantastic. What an awesome example to wrap things up on. Well, Nigel, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you. I think we could probably speak about learning technologies forever, but we won't subject people to that. But if people do want to find out more and specifically more about, you know, your journey on your books, where's the best place they can go to do that?
Probably www.nigelpayne.com. Just go to my website. You can follow me on LinkedIn. I'm Nigel Payne at LinkedIn. On Twitter, I'm Ebase, E-B-A-S-E, which is, I won't go into why I'm Ebase on Twitter. So you can pick me up in various places, and there's a long trail. I'm lucky to be, if you put Nigel Payne into Google, I come up first. So you can find me easily. I'm not good or bad. I'm certainly not a shy wolf on social media. I'm there, and you can connect with me. I'd be glad to connect with you.
Fantastic. Well, Nigel, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking, and hope you have an enjoyable rest of your evening in Australia and get back to the UK safely very, very soon.